Good morning. Welcome to hour number two of Focus 580. It's our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Kyle Mabry, is at the controls this morning. We're also pleased to have back with us once again on the program Dr. Jeff Swearingen. He is a family practice doctor from Carl Clinic in Urbana. He is here every other month on a Monday for the show we call Talk to the Family Doctor. The idea is we have somebody who deals with a lot of different folks, people of different ages, with a variety of health concerns. And so whatever is on your mind can be for yourself, can be for someone close to you, could be a pediatrics kind of thing, because he sees children in his practice. So it can be just about anything. If you have a basic kind of healthcare question, give us a call, and I know he'll do his best to help you out. Given that, of course, I try to say this every time, given that he can't see you, We truly can't do diagnosis over the telephone, but we do the shows to try to help you out and provide some basic knowledge, maybe answer some basic questions. So your call is welcome. We'll do our best. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana. We do also have a toll-free line. Good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455 at any point. Give us a call. Well, thanks very much for being here.
Thank you, David. Good to be back.
Doctor came in this morning and said he is just now in the early stages of a cold. So this proves that nobody is immune.
And periodically I have to get something so that I have some ongoing empathy for the folks who come into the office so that
good.
I can say, yes, I know how you feel.
Well, I'm sure that it's a professional hazard because, after all, you're seeing sick people all day
time,
long.
Right.
And I don't know how it is that you are actually not sick all the time.
I wash my hands 50 times a day.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, there again, that we've talked about this over and over again. One simple thing that you can do to try to keep yourself from getting sick is wash your hands, because there's so much stuff everywhere. And you touch it, and then so you got it. Well, anyway, you know, one thing I am sure I've asked you this before, and I was just thinking about this myself because I was struggling with about a month or so ago, with this cold that was going around. It seemed like about half of the people here had had it. Why is it seems, that when you're sick, your symptoms get worse at night? Is there actually an explanation for that?
Yes, two. One, during the day, you're busy.
Okay. So you're distracted.
So you're distracted. You're focusing on other things. And then finally at night, there's nothing to distract you. And you go, oh, gee, there are all those symptoms. Yeah. And for many respiratory types of illnesses, the stuffy noses, the colds, the sinus problems, the bronchitis, in fact, the human body works best when we are upright. Almost all of our internal drainage systems are geared for us to be in the upright posture. So when you lay down, they all don't function nearly as well. And a lot of that mucousy, congested kind of feeling tends to accumulate. And the other part of that is that you're not hydrating yourself at night like you do during the day. So those secretions tend to get thicker, because you're a little drier, relatively speaking. And they also tend to pool because you're laying down. So they tend to congregate and becomes much more noticeable when you're at night. So oftentimes we try to remind people, maintain really, really good hydration before you go to bed. A nice hot steamy shower. Loosen everything up. Get it out. Blow your nose. Cough up anything that you can get rid of. And then in many instances we'll tell people, prop yourself up a little bit at night. You know, two or three pillows so you're on a slant, or if you've got a lazy boy recliner, that'll work as well. And take advantage of the fact that our drainage systems do, in fact, work better when we're upright.
Okay. Well, that makes perfect sense. I guess partly I was thinking, well, maybe it's just that at the end of the day also that you're tired. And it just seems that kind of adds to your burden of how you feel.
I think that's probably true as well.
Feeling sort of worn out, it's the end of the day, and your ability to bear up. But I too, though, take the point that, as you say, you're busy, you're doing things during the daytime, and you're upright.
Yep.
And all of that seems to help. Okay, well, that's good answers to the question. Very good. We have a caller here to talk with in Effingham, so let's talk with them. Line number four.
Yes, sir. Can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
This phone from which I'm speaking has got a nasty habit of cutting off, but it usually comes back within 5 or 10 seconds. I heard a doctor, I believe his name is Zorman, I believe he's also on NPR, mentioned in a study was done about diabetes on the effect of sugar on the diabetic. And what it came down to was that two groups, or maybe three, I'm not sure, but one group was given normal sugar, one was given very little sugar, and the other one was given a lot of sugar. It turns out that the conclusion was, tentative naturally, that sugar does not really cause the blood sugar level, whatever it is. Do you happen to know anything about that study?
I'm not familiar with the specific study that you're mentioning, but I will comment on the fact that it's not just sugar in our diet that raises our internal blood levels of glucose, which is
but
the sugar.
It's a key ingredient that's said to be at fault. I know it's carbohydrates and pasta and all that sort of stuff.
Correct. And in fact, virtually all foods, once digested, become some type of sugar or fat. So in many instances, it's the total number of calories that people are consuming over the course of the day. Things that are, in fact, sweet, what we would refer to as, you know, simple carbohydrates, are more rapidly digested and internally absorbed. So you can get a spike in your blood glucose level quicker after a donut than you would, say, after a granola bar or an apple. But if the total number of calories is the same, ultimately your body is going to metabolize it in such a way that it produces sugar and fat, and it's the long-term effects of that that determine whether the diabetes is going to be well controlled or not.
Okay, well, you haven't heard of this study. It's a recent study.
No, I have not heard of
that
specifically.
You happen to know that doctor, Dr. Zorba?
I don't recognize that name.
Is he not the man that you're with there? Is he know him? Is he not an NPR?
No, I'm afraid that no, I don't. The name, but I suppose we could do a Google search and see what
I could do that myself. I just happen to be. He's, besides being giving good advice, he's very funny, too.
Okay.
Thanks very much.
Well, thanks for the call. Other questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. Is there some reason to think that it's better to do thing to try to keep your, even if you don't think that you have blood sugar issues, you don't have diabetes, maybe you don't have family history of diabetes, is it though still better to think about trying to eat in a way that maintains, relatively speaking, a fairly level blood sugar level so that it's not wildly fluctuating, so you don't get big peaks and big troughs in it?
Right. And that is reasonable, because when it peaks rapidly at a high level, you send a signal to your body to release larger quantities of insulin in order to bring it back down. And if, in fact, you overshoot and your sugar levels end up being too low, then people generally don't feel very good. This isn't diabetes, but you're yo-yoing your sugars up and down rapidly, and you're just not going to feel very well. Long-term, if you constantly overload your system and you get to a point where you can't control that return of the blood sugar because your insulin levels are at their maximum levels already, then you're going to lose control of your blood sugars, and you're going to meet the definition of diabetes. And this occurs in individuals who are heavy. Basically, the fat cells in our body tend to be resistant to the effect of insulin. So most of the, at least the adult insulin patients, don't have a deficiency of insulin. What they have is too much fat, which is resisting the effects of their insulin. They're unable to bring their sugars down, and they meet the definition of diabetes. And that extra weight is simply the end result of extra calories. We have folks who say, gee, I eat a healthy diet, to which I say, you're eating 5,000 calories a day. Unless you're, you know, running a marathon, you probably don't need to be consuming 5,000 calories a day. Mm-hmm. So even if it's healthy food, if it's more calories than you really need, that's ultimately going to turn into sugar and fat in one way or the other, and that long-term will have adverse complications.
Okay. Well, let's take some other callers. We have two, and they're both in Champaign, so we'll go first to line number one. Hello.
Yes, doctor.
Yes.
I have a 12-year-old son who we're kind of struggling on what may be this problem, but we're kind of zeroing it down to acid reflux, basically. But on Wednesday at Carl, he's scheduled to have, I believe, what is called a pH test,
mm-hmm.
where they're going to insert a tube down to his stomach, through his nose, down his esophagus for a couple days. Can you, I'm going to hang up and listen, but could you kind of describe that test and how uncomfortable it is to have the procedure done and exactly what they'll be looking for? And I'll just listen off the air. Thank you.
Okay. All right. Acid in our stomach is a normal part of digestion. It's one of the things that helps break down food so that we can absorb the nutrients. And your stomach is designed to hold acid. So when you simply have the normal amount of acid in your stomach, you don't normally feel it. You don't have any complaints related to it. Now, your esophagus, the tube that connects your mouth to your stomach, is not designed to hold acid. And so if stomach acid goes backwards up into the esophagus, it stimulates a response that's painful, and this is where the term heartburn comes from, because many people describe a burning-like sensation, which is a result of the acid coming in contact with a surface that's not designed or isn't protected from the effects of acid like the stomach is. So in situations where you're trying to evaluate whether this is the cause of someone's symptoms or not, you can put a probe down into the esophagus. As the caller mentioned, this can be a small tube placed through the nose, down the back of the throat, into the esophagus. And it has a pH probe, which is a little device to measure how acidic the environment is. If you dropped it all the way into the stomach, you would find that it's very acidic. If you brought it back up into the esophagus and everything's normal, you should find that there isn't much acid. So the device will be put in place, and then over the course of a day or so, they'll take periodic readings to see what the pH does. If it remains normal, then there's probably not much in the way of acid getting from the stomach back up into the esophagus. On the other hand, if there are periodic times when the pH drops significantly, indicating a much more acidic environment, that's pretty good evidence that acid from the stomach is getting back up into the esophagus. The test itself isn't painful at all, but it's, I would have to say, at least mildly uncomfortable to have something in your nose, but otherwise shouldn't be in any way a painful experience.
Okay. And acid reflux is something that there seems to be a lot of it around, and certainly people are taking medication for that. In what circumstances would you want to go to the point of doing a test like this? I mean,
in many instances, it's done in situations where, despite medications to lower acid production, patients continue to have symptoms. And you're either scratching your head saying, gee, is this really what the problem is? Or am I going to need to look at some other form of treatment if, in fact, this is what it is? There are a few unfortunate folks who, watch their diet, try and lose weight, which is a major contributor to this problem, take their medications to reduce acid production, and yet still have lots of symptoms. Now, these days, there is a surgical procedure to snug up the connection between the esophagus and the stomach, making it harder for fluids to go backwards out of the stomach up into the esophagus. And so this type of test is often done prior to people considering that type of surgery.
All right. The next caller is also in Champaign and line number two. Hello.
Hi. Just a comment about just what you were saying, and then I have another question. But one of the things I found, I suffered for years with acid reflux, and what happened is I also suffered from seasonal allergies. Well, I went through a full battery of allergy testing and found that I was very allergic to very common foods I was eating, and since I've adjusted my diet to account for that, I have had very few episodes of acid reflux. I'm no longer in any of those medications at all, and it's surprising to me that my gastroenterologist didn't mention that that might be something that would be occurring, and instead we tried all kinds of different things to manage it. So sometimes it's a simple fix. Sometimes it's more complicated, like you were saying, you need surgery. But, I mean, there should be some way that or someone who can just say, have you thought about this? Let's rule that one out as well, and instead of going to a progressive, more, you know, invasive kind of procedure.
Well, I'd have to say that food allergies as a direct cause for acid reflux would be way, way down on the list of causes. So it's not a common occurrence. Now, certain people will find that just certain foods give them more symptoms. I would have to say tomatoes are a fairly common culprit here, in that the acidity of a particular food just generates that much more acid in the stomach, and so symptoms are sometimes worse. That's not necessarily an allergic response, but certainly altering diet will improve the symptoms.
Right. I think it's just hard to say which, because what I was always told is stay away from chocolate, alcohol, as well as mint, which was surprising to me. As far as acid reflux as something that really contributes to it to a large extent. And I did that, and it still wasn't improving. But once I changed my diet to, you know, to get rid of all the things that were affecting me, it could have been it's a compounded thing where certain foods then, you know, make the environment, you know, more ripe for acid to be produced or something like that. And with the allergy to that, just really getting them out of the way was really helpful. But, you know, it's kind of interesting, too. Again, I think having a good internal medical specialist or general medical practitioner that's overseeing everything that you're doing and can kind of integrate all the different things going on, that's probably the best route to go, and something I should have thought about earlier. Okay, so my question, here's the thing. So diabetes runs in the family, and that the earlier question from the gentleman kind of triggered. And so, you know, I always wondered, on the testing of it, people test all the time, right? And I guess when you have diabetes or maybe you're maybe predisposition for it or something. What are the testing ranges? Or I know they're changing all the time, but you know, when do you test during a day? And what do you expect to see? Or what is the preferred range of that glucose level that doctors are wanting to see to make sure that you're not a candidate for, you know, something more, you know, having to take more medicine or anything like that. So if you could just answer some of those simple things, I hope they're simple. I'll ring off and listen.
Okay.
Thank you.
In terms of screening for diabetes, certainly adult patients, if they have a family history of diabetes, it's reasonable as part of just your annual exam to have a fasting blood sugar checked. The caller alluded to the fact that the numbers for interpretation are, in fact, changing. In the past, a fasting blood sugar of 110 was considered acceptable. In the last couple of years, they pushed that number down to 100 based on data that suggests the closer that number is to 100 or less, the less likely you are to have diabetic complications. And so the criteria for defining diabetes have changed here recently. But if you have a fasting blood sugar and it's over 125, and it's consistently over 125 on more than one occasion, that's sort of the chemical test definition of diabetes. And those folks should then be watching their diet. They should be getting some exercise. They should be attempting to get some weight off, because in many instances that's what's causing it, along with that genetic predisposition. And then in terms of medication, that will simply depend on how well the blood sugars are controlled. in terms of testing your blood sugar during the course of the day, that tells you what your sugar is right that moment. And it can tell you if in the fasting state it's normal or how high it went after you ate. Everybody's blood sugar goes up after they eat. If you're not diabetic, it should rapidly come back down into the normal range. If you're diabetic, it tends to go a little higher and take a little bit longer before it comes back down to normal. And if you're not a well-controlled diabetic, it may never come back down to normal. It just bounces around above where it's supposed to be and shoots up even higher every time you eat. So the other type of test that is done is referred to as an A1C, or glycosylated hemoglobin, which is why A1C is easier to say. But this is a number that is generated that indicates over the last several months, have my blood sugars been generally normal or a little high or way too high? This number for non-diabetic patients is typically under 6. If your diabetes is well controlled, it's under 7. If your sugars are consistently too high, your A1C is going to be above 7, and you're going to need to work with your physician to bring that down. Basically, because we know that the long-term complications of diabetes are much more likely to accrue to those individuals whose blood sugars aren't well controlled. In the long run, diabetes tends to be a vascular disease. It causes damage to blood vessels. So you see people who have retinal problems. Diabetes is probably the second leading cause of blindness in the United States. It's the leading cause for amputations. You folks have heard of people who've had, you know, toes or feet amputated. And again, this is the circulatory problem. Kidney problems, again, the number one cause for dialysis or transplant in the United States is poorly controlled diabetes. And this is a result of damage to the circulation of the kidneys. They have a much higher incidence of heart disease and strokes. All of the vascular problems accrue to diabetics who aren't well controlled. We don't have a good test to measure how people's blood vessels are doing. What we do is measure what's easiest, and that's the blood sugar. And there is a good correlation between poorly controlled blood sugars and an increased risk of vascular complications long term. And so the goal is to bring the sugars down in hopes of minimizing the vascular damage over the long run. And there is good data that says if you start out early and aggressively and keep those sugars down, you can indeed minimize the chance of those vascular complications. So the folks who are taking medication, especially if they're on insulin, will monitor their blood sugars during the course of the day to make sure that it's not too high or too low. But long term, you want to get your A1C checked and make sure that you're keeping it below 7 to minimize those diabetic complications.
All right. Well, hope that helps. Just to ask again a basic question, the basic screening that you're talking about, and this is the test where you say to someone, all right, what I want you to do is I want you to go 8 hours at least without eating.
Right.
And then you got to come down here to the office. We're going to take some blood, and we're going to test the blood sugar. And
correct.
So fasting, that's what it means. You're gone without eating. And then you come up with a number, and depending on that number, then you sort of go from there.
Right. And if it's less than 100, that's normal.
That's fine.
And the standard recommendations, if you know, eat a healthy diet, get some exercise, keep your weight down. And if you have a family history of diabetes, check it again next year is probably all that needs to be done. One specific extra patient category that I would mention, women who had diabetes during pregnancy, what's called gestational diabetes. Pregnancy is sort of a diabetic stress test. And if you flunk it, your diabetes usually goes away when you're not pregnant. But it's a marker for a much higher increased risk for diabetes later in life, even when you're not pregnant. So those folks really should be monitored very, very closely, because there's a very high likelihood, somewhere between 35 to 50% of women who are diabetic during their pregnancy will be diabetic later in life.
Yeah. So, and the fasting blood sugar, would you do that theoretically, would you do that for everybody, or mostly is that for people that you know have a family history of diabetes?
Certainly for folks with a family history of diabetes, mm-hmm. but a blood sugar or glucose level is a standard part of many chemistry panels. So even mm-hmm. if you're checking something else, whether it's kidney disease or liver disease or getting your cholesterol, in many instances, the glucose is in there. So if you're getting your blood drawn and you're fasting, in many instances, it's already there. So for a lot of folks, even if they weren't at high risk, they're getting screened periodically.
Okay. We're midway through this part of Focus 580. Our guest, Dr. Jeff Swearingen. He's a family practice doctor at Carle Clinic in Urbana. He is on the program every other month on a Monday for the show. We call it Talk to the Family Doctor. So if you have a question, a healthcare question, can be for yourself, somebody in your family, we can talk about grown-ups, we can talk about kids, any and all of that, I know the doctor will do his best to help you out. 333-9455 and toll-free, 800-222-9455. I just want to go back just for a minute earlier in the show. Right off at the beginning, we started talking about diabetes, and I said, "Would you say that you would be better off if you ate in a way that tried to maintain a fairly constant blood sugar level, or at least what you want to do is if you can't avoid these really wide swings where it goes way up and way down, where you're having these big fluctuations? So if the idea is, well, yes, it would be a good idea to try to maintain a relatively within a certain range." What does one do to do that?
For most individuals, if they wanted to attempt that, they would eat smaller but more frequent meals so that there's not a prolonged period of time where there's nothing in your system. And you would choose foods that are more slowly digested so that they get into your system at a slower rate. And that's, again, the difference between the donut and the apple. They both may have the same amount of calories, though that would seem to have to be a really big apple or a really small donut. But the one is very rapidly absorbed into the system because it's mostly sugar, and the other is a much more complex carbohydrate, takes longer to get into the system, so you don't get those peaks. And then if you don't get the peaks, you usually don't get the valleys as well.
Then we will talk with some more folks here. And another champagne person here, line number one. Hello.
Hello. Mm-hmm. I have a question about the restless leg syndrome. My husband has been suffering from this illness for a number of years. He would become extremely nervous at 10 o'clock at night, and it would last until 3 o'clock, and then he would be able to go to sleep. And now that nervousness affects him at any time of the day and night, and he's almost unable to sleep. He tried to take some different types of medications available on the market. They are not entirely for this illness because apparently the reason of this illness is not known. It's completely unknown. Hence, I was wondering if there is a research that is in progress, and is it known to a degree what could be the cause of this illness, and what is the future? What is the future possible treatments?
Excellent question. The short answer is no. Nobody knows the exact cause yet. There have been some studies that have implicated an association, and I don't want to say a cause, but at least an association, where low levels of iron in the body seem to aggravate the symptoms of people who have restless leg syndrome. So in some instances, as part of the evaluation for restless leg, folks will check iron levels. There's a storage form of iron in the body called ferritin, and it gives you a pretty good idea of your overall balance of iron in your system. If that's low, some individuals have found that an iron supplement will, in fact, make their symptoms better. But not everybody gets benefit. Not everybody who has restless leg syndrome has low iron. There are a number of prescription medications available for restless leg syndrome if, in fact, the symptoms are bad enough to warrant it. And most of those medications are seemingly medications similar to Parkinson's medications.
I tried all of them.
Right. The other point I guess I would emphasize is that restless leg syndrome can be seen in conjunction with other sleep disorders. And so if there hasn't been a formal evaluation of other sleep diagnoses, it would be a very reasonable thing to review, because there may be other conditions besides restless leg contributing to the difficulty with sleep.
Thank you very much. I have one more question related to that. You mentioned the iron. Is it, could it be related to the cells' permeability in the brain? Because one might have a sufficient reserve of iron, but the iron might not go through the cell, through the brain cells. Do we know something about that?
That is something I do not know anything about. As you said, there is ongoing research, and hopefully that will be answered in the future, but I don't know the answer to that question right now.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for the call. We will continue and next talk with someone in who's also in Champaign and on line number two. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. First of all, I have what they call Barrett syndrome. And I also discovered that one of the problems that can happen with what you think is your acid reflux coming back can be a post-shingles neuropathy. I think they call it post-hepatic, something like that, neuropathy. And so when you think you've got acid reflux, it's really the neuropathy acting up. My other question is, when you have trouble with sugar with a GERD, with the acid reflux, do you know if Splenda can be used instead of sugar? Does it have the same effect on it? And one more comment. I wish Carl had an acid reflux support group. Thank you.
Okay. I'm not quite sure I got the whole question in terms of diabetes and acid reflux. Splenda as a sugar substitute, again, is fine. What typically people are looking at trying to do is reduce their total number of simple carbohydrates and calories overall. Anything that allows you to eat less will minimize reflux symptoms, because when your stomach's really, really full, it's easier for things to go backwards up the esophagus. But otherwise, I'm not aware of any direct correlation between the use of Splenda and its effect on GERD. We do know that diabetic patients long-term can develop what are called autonomic neuropathies, and the nerve cells that stimulate the intestinal tract to work become damaged over a long period of time. So we know that the digestive process in some diabetic patients is not normal as a result of their diabetes. And that's, again, another long-term complication. And it's something that, again, the emphasis needs to be at the beginning of the diabetes to control it as well as possible to avoid these long-term complications.
Mm-hmm. Is it, well, maybe as a general kind of question, there are probably a number of things that can cause symptoms that might be interpreted as heartburn. Maybe that would be one. Are there, so one might think, oh, I have heartburn, or maybe you'd say, one, I'm having reflux. Are there some things actually that it could be something else completely?
Well, the last caller mentioned that she had Barrett's esophagus, and this refers to some changes in the cells of the esophagus, typically closer to the stomach, where it is thought that the constant exposure to acid actually causes physical damage and change in the cells lining the esophagus. folks who have Barrett's, when you biopsy their esophagus, those cells look different than normal. And the concern here is that those folks are more likely than folks who don't have those changes to develop cancer of the esophagus. Mm-hmm. So folks who have Barrett's disease are usually monitored by endoscopy on a fairly regular basis in those areas, biopsied to make sure that any malignant change is picked up at an early stage.
Okay. I think maybe we actually have that caller back with us, and maybe we can get some clarification. I just want to make sure that we have answered the question. Are you there in Champaign, line one?
I'm here.
Yes.
Yeah, I wanted to know, I know that sugar is bad for an acid reflux. Would substituting Splenda help? I mean, could you tolerate that better?
Well,
acid reflux.
Sugar in and of itself isn't necessarily bad for reflux. I mean, there's nothing directly stimulating about sugar in and of itself that adversely affects reflux.
Well, I don't know. It's just in the list of things that you need to watch if you have acid reflux. Okay. All right. And then, okay, thank you.
Okay. Well, again, we'll go on to the next caller, and that's someone in Watsika on our toll-free line, line four. Hello.
Yes, thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
On my blood test, triglycerides are always way below the norms, and they're going down even further. Is that a problem with cholesterol?
No. When people have blood work done, they frequently get what's called a lipid panel, and lipids simply refer to fats that normally circulate in the bloodstream.
Mm-hmm.
The most common one that people are aware of is cholesterol, but the other common one that gets measured as part of that is triglycerides. Cholesterol, we know, of the wrong kind in too high a quantity is associated with cardiovascular disease. To a certain extent, if your triglycerides are too high, this too contributes to cardiovascular disease, but not nearly as big a risk as cholesterol. But they're often measured at the same time. And they come from different dietary sources. When you think of your cholesterol, you think of the red meats, the fatty things, the fried things, the greasy, you know, those sorts of things. Triglycerides, on the other hand, come from, and this comes back to our diabetes, is the simple carbohydrates, the sweets, the sugars, and in many instances, alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
So if you think of sweets and alcohol as the source of your triglycerides, and you don't have a lot of that in your diet, then your triglycerides are going to be low, and that's fine. There's nothing harmful about them being lower than average.
Oh, okay.
At all. And both cholesterol and triglycerides are significantly impacted by our diet and our exercise habits.
Mm-hmm.
But there are also families who have inherited problems with lipids. And you can inherit a problem with your cholesterol or your triglycerides or both if you're really unlucky.
Mm-hmm.
But in most individuals, it's truly what they're eating, how much they're eating, and their exercise that determines what their lipid panel looks like.
Does the CHD risk have anything to do with the cholesterol?
Yes. The higher your total cholesterol, especially if the majority of it is your LDL,
mm-hmm.
which is commonly referred to as the bad cholesterol,
mm-hmm.
The higher those levels are, the more likely somebody is to have cardiovascular problems.
Oh, okay.
And that's where a lot of emphasis is placed on diet and exercise, is to get the total cholesterol to come down as a result of dropping the bad levels of cholesterol, the LDL. And that's where exercise comes in, because exercise raises the good levels
mm-hmm.
of your cholesterol, the HDL, and lowers your LDL.
I see. And one more question: what is the globulin? GLUBULIN.
It's a protein that's in the bloodstream, and in most instances, is a reflection of the adequacy of nutrition. If it's really low, most of those folks are probably malnourished.
Oh, okay.
All right.
Thank you well, so thank much. You.
We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Our guest is Dr. Jeff Swearingen. He's a family practice physician from Carl Clinic in Urbana. Every other month he's here for the show we call Talk to the Family Doctor, and we try to answer as many questions as we can. 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. I'm not sure. Kyle is on line two. Is that a new caller, or is it somebody that we've already done? We'll see if we can find out here. And, of course, we'll take whatever questions we can. Certainly, we have time for a few more. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana and toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, in the meantime here, just because there seems to be some confusion, maybe let me ask you a basic question about acid reflux. There, it seemed that there are some things that aggravate the symptoms and that people who have reflux are – the suggestion is here's a list of stuff. You're probably better off if you avoid these things or at least, you know, keep it to a minimum. So what are the basic things?
The first one is anything that you notice that gives you trouble is probably something
best. Make up your own list.
Best avoid. Yeah. Truly, it is.
Yes. Yes.
But fairly common things are, in fact, foods that are acidic. So many people will complain, gee, after, you know, the pizza with all the tomato sauce, you know, I have trouble. Or when I go out for Mexican and it's, you know, hot and spicy, I have trouble. Mm-hmm. Well, for most folks, they just need to avoid things that they know that are directly aggravating. But in many instances, we're going to suggest that they minimize the fat content of their diet, because fatty foods tend to promote reflux. Caffeine is a problem. Alcohol is a problem. Nicotine is a problem. This isn't necessarily because all of those things produce more acid in the stomach, but some of these chemical substances actually cause relaxation of the sphincter, which is the little valve at the bottom of your esophagus. Normally, this lower esophageal sphincter should, if it's working correctly, pretty much operate as a one-way valve. It should allow things to go down into your stomach, but not allow things to come back up, which is why it's so uncomfortable when you want to throw up, because you're going...
It's not supposed to go that way.
But in many instances, these other chemicals that we ingest basically make that sphincter less effective, consequently allowing even normal amounts of acid in the stomach to get up into the esophagus. So those are some of the reasons why it's not just acid production in the stomach that's going on that contributes to this problem. And consequently, there are times when people say, gee, you know, I've reduced all my acid, but I'm still having trouble. There are medications to try and snug up that sphincter. And then there are the surgical procedures we talked about to physically try and snug that up as well.
Yeah. Okay. Let's talk with some other folks. And next, we'll have somebody from Champaign in line one. Hello. Well, okay. How about line number three? This is also Champaign. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Have you talked about achalasia?
No.
Do you know anything about it?
Just a little.
Well, you just talked about the sphincter.
Right.
That may not open.
Right.
Do you know any studies on that?
Nothing recent. It's not a common problem, and I have to admit that I am not current in that area.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Sorry. Is that the sort of the opposite problem than what we've been?
Well, it's another esophageal disorder. There's actually a fair number of fairly common disorders in the esophagus, but far and away the most common relates to reflux symptoms.
Yeah. All right. Well, next, let's talk with someone in Georgetown. This would be line number four. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I know I haven't heard all the programs, so I may have missed out on something that you've covered. A couple of questions. I did have problems with acid reflux, and thank goodness I was able to by eliminating the caffeine, the chocolate, and those things that you mentioned, and I don't have to take medication anymore because the medication caused me more side effects, in the bowel and the stomach area, and so I had to get off of that, and thank goodness so far I've been able to regulate it. But a couple other questions. I know you talked some about diabetes this morning. I had heard once that some of the, as we know, a lot of these drugs we take for one problem then causes other problems. And I had heard once, but I've never heard again or seen any literature on that, that some of the cholesterol-lowering drugs, and specifically the one that I had heard was the Lipitor, had caused, or they were trying to figure out if that didn't cause some people to become diabetic because there was, like, no history of diabetes in their family or anything. Have you heard any more studies done on that or anything about that?
I am not aware of any connection between the use of Lipitor or even any of the other statin medications that are prescribed for cholesterol causing diabetes. So, no, I'm not aware of that.
Okay.
But your previous comment about taking medication causing another problem, I think is very, very telling in the sense that many people say, oh, give me a pill for this or that. And everything that has an effect potentially has side effects. So there is always this trade-off.
Right.
Of, you know, I'm going to treat this with some sort of medication. Well, what's the potential downside?
Right.
And people need to really think about taking medication for conditions that could, in fact, be improved. You're an excellent example of somebody who says, well, I'm not tolerating my medications very well for my reflux. I'm going to change my lifestyle. I'm going to get rid of the caffeine and the alcohol and the tobacco and the fat and the chocolate. And I'm going to do better that way, which is a much healthier approach to treatment.
And I've had another problem in that I was beginning stages from the bone density test that I would be prone for osteoporosis, and I was concerned with that because I had a mother and an aunt that were. So when the doctors prescribed the bisphosphonate for me to take, I took it. And I had some problems with the actinol, so then they put me on Boniva. And I had lots of problems with that. So I went off. Well, I was not aware that when you go off of those, then there is a drain on your bones. And once you start those, from what the pharmacist told me, you pretty much need to take one of those because I ended up with then a crack in the vertebrae in the middle of my back when I was doing some yard work. And when she noticed that I had gone off the Boniva and was no longer taking it, she said, oh, my, you need to get back on bisphosphonate, one of those drugs, mm-hmm. So now they have me on Fosamax. But, and then there's some dental problems with loss of bone, et cetera, and when I just talked to my dentist, he said, you know, when those drugs came out, they thought they were, ooh, the answer for osteoporosis, they was going to just do all these miracle things, but now they're finding out, whoops, maybe they weren't so miracle because they cause other problems.
Right.
So, anyway, my comment. Thanks.
Thank you.
Let's see. We'll try to get at least one more caller here, and that would be Champagne and line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
How are you doing, sir?
Good.
Well, I just have an advice for all these people who's been on medication and trying to get all this medication. And, you know, as you know, everyone, that medication has a side effect, as you mentioned just now and the lady mentioned it. So my advice is for them to do yoga, and I hope it's going to be a higher field in yoga that people go and investigate and analyze which teachers they should join, because there's so many yoga and there's so many experts in yoga. We have a teacher here in Champaign, in Urbana. Her name is Lois Steinberg, and she's expert in yoga. So my advice to all these people who want to avoid medication to try another alternative. And thank you.
Well, all right. I think that's excellent advice. Anything that contributes generally to your state of health, mind, body, could be yoga, could be Tai Chi, could be going for a walk every day, you know.
I'm all in favor.
You can't argue against that. So I appreciate the thought of the caller. When you get a prescription filled, you go down to the pharmacy, and I think generally what they're going to do is they're going to give you a sheet of paper that will say something like, here's what it's for, here's the way we want you to take it, there are some potential side effects, and this is what some of them are. If you have any concerns about this, you know, let your doctor know. Some of the things that are listed as side effects, well, they could be side effects of the medication, but they could not they could be, that could be something else causing that side effect. How do you, and you know, for people who are taking the medicine and they're sort of feeling like, hey, I'm not sure something's right here. I mean, how do you decide, is that the medication or is there something else that's causing that?
The ultimate test, when folks ask, gee, could whatever I'm experiencing, whatever symptom I have, is this a side effect of this medication? The answer is stop taking the medication. Does the symptom go away? Mm. When you restart the medication, does it come right back? Okay, that's pretty much probably going to be cause and effect if you can repeatedly do that. Now, depending on how bad the symptom is, some people don't even want to take it again to find out if that's the case. But if it doesn't go away when you stop taking the medication, then that's probably not the medication that's causing the symptom. So in most instances, we tell folks, if you think you're having a problem, call us. Let us know what you're doing. We'll be happy to discuss either cutting the dose down or stopping it temporarily. But in many, many instances, there really isn't a test as such that you can say, oh, I'm going to do this blood test or I'm going to do this x-ray and I'll figure out if it's a side effect. It's typically stop taking it, see if the symptom goes away, see if it comes back when you resume the medication.
Okay. And I'm sure that you would say before making that decision to stop taking the medication, call the doctor.
Correct.
Don't just stop.
Correct.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.
Jeff Swearingen, he's a family practice doctor at Carl Clinic in Urbana. Every other month on a Monday, he's here for the show. We call Talk to the Family Doctor.